Thank you, Bengt. I feel very strange with this thing on my face here. I feel like singing or something. What I'm supposed to talk about is time resolution and some of the recent or state-of-the-art applications as far as chemistry and some applications in biology. But for the students, you might be intrigued by this transparency, which we all try to draw in different forms. I'm showing here the time and going to this end into the age of the universe, about 12 billion years, and remarkably, the age of the Earth and all of this enduring phenomena on this side. But on the other hand, if you go to the sub-second world, you come into at the end of this world here, which is the atoms and the electrons. There's incredible symmetry here going from the age of the universe to the age of the motion of atoms and electrons. Actually, as Professor Nordheim pointed out, motions of atoms, this I found recently, I was in Greece last summer, and it's on 10 drachma right now, and this is Democritus, the father for the concept of the atom. But the atom has never really been seen in motion. We have new techniques now to see atoms on surfaces by scanning tonic microscopy and so on. But to see the atoms in motion, it's conceptually and technically was not feasible. And why is that? Well, just again, for the students in the audience, in way of review, if you look at the quantum system, which is the atom and the electrons belongs to, and you draw the potential energy for which the atoms are moving against the nuclear separation between the atoms, then of course, as you know, in the quantum world, this is a probability function. To find the system in a given quantum state, the probability of finding it at essentially all internuclear distances is finite. And so when you deal with an experiment that averaging over time, you do not see any motion, and you just simply see a probability over all distances. In order for you to see motions, and I'm not going to dwell too much because I have new things to share with you, you have two things to keep in mind. One is, in fact, is to shorten the time, take it all the way to the femtosecond. You can transform a quantum system with a probability over all nuclear distances into a system which is localized in space. And you can speak of what the physicists will call a wave packet, or meaning that you can speak now almost classically as a system being at so-and-so angstrom, moving after so-and-so femtosecond into a new distance, going on back and forth. But that's not sufficient, because it turns out one of the fundamentals of this field is the fact that you have to utilize coherence. And you will hear from Professor Ernst also in NMR, this is a very powerful concept, the idea of coherence. And if you don't use the concept of coherence here, then there is an obstacle called the uncertainty principle, which might be in a way of thinking about how to localize the atoms in space. And for the students, I want to remind you with Young double slit interference, where you have a monochromatic light and you're passing through two pinholes and you make these fringes here. And the fringes are made because of coherence. On the other hand, actually, we did this theoretically. If you increase the number of slits from 2 to 6, for example, then you can localize the fringes at around the middle here, and now you have the equivalent of localizing the nuclei in space and time. So this is a key point to keep in mind, that it is the idea of localizing the atoms in space and time in order to be able to see its motion. One of the obstacles in the beginning of the field was to think that this might be violating the uncertainty principle, because now the time is very short, therefore the energy resolution is very large, and it's as if you're ruining the quantum states of the molecule. But This was published in Nature recently. But if you combine this actually with the other uncertainty principle, which is between distance and momentum, you can see very clearly energy correlates with momentum, so you can localize the nuclei in space if you shorten the time, provided you do the experiment coherently. I found it amazing that Charlie Towne told me that the same idea of the uncertainty principle, he wrote this in his book, I.I. Rabi was objecting to the concept of the maser, that it would never work because also the uncertainty principle will be against it. So Charlie wrote, to many physicists steeped in the uncertainty principle, the maser performance made no sense at all. Again, there was the thinking that as the ammonia molecules, for example, transverse in the making of the maser, there will be a finite transit time and it would be impossible to get a very pure frequency coming out of it. But it turns out that the coherence and the stimulated emission is a key concept here if you wanted the laser or the maser to work. So for the advanced students in quantum mechanics, here is the bottom line, which is very simple to understand. Why does it work? Even though the energy resolution is so broad and you would have thought that the uncertainty principle is against you. Well, you know from your quantum mechanics textbooks is that when the molecules is discrete and you have quantum states, that the Planck's constant is non-zero. But as you go to higher energy and the system is continuum, then we say by Ehrenfest's theorem is that actually H goes to zero. You are now in the classical regime. So actually by opening this lousy in energy type pulses, but at short time, you are able to convert this discrete system almost into a continuum system coherently. And therefore, even though we're dealing with a quantum system, we are in a classical limit where we can define now a velocity for the atom and a trajectory in a space and time. And it works. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking to you here. And in fact, you can refer to the fact that now in the classical world, we can speak of atomic scale resolution. We can speak of the speed of the atoms about a kilometer per second, which is 10 to the plus 5 centimeter per second. The distance scale we're talking about is about an angstrom. And between these two, you come up with femtosecond time resolution. Put in a more fancy way, if the time resolution is now shorter than the vibrational period of the molecule or the rotational period of the molecule, then you can freeze these atoms in space and time, again, provided we prepare the system in a coherent fashion, as we said. So this is an opportunity to have a femtoscope now to look at all the atoms in molecules and classically, and I'm just going to remind you that this was done long time ago, just one transparency to show you that you really can speak of it classically. Here is the two atoms connected with a spring. And if you looked at this in a quantum system, that will be the wave function with a probability, again, as a function of distance. But if you did this experiment with 10 femtosecond resolution, you localize this spring at 2.7 angstrom, and you can speak of the motion at this distance and the spring stretched here classically. And you can see this going up and down, precisely following this motion of a spring, two atoms on a spring moving back and forth. And whether you do it in a two-atom system, this is a fancy transparency of one of my students using PowerPoints, and I don't know how to do these things, but he does it very well. Whether you're doing it in the two atoms or you're doing it in the rhodopsin in your eye, it's the same idea, and you can see the atomic scale resolution of this. So the field have actually grown into many areas, not only by us, but by many colleagues around the world. And what I would like to share with you today is just some of the new directions we're taking on in the biological world of proteins. We do also work on DNA and the other things, molecular recognitions, interference, supramolecular systems in honor of Jean-Marie Len here. And so we do a variety of things, but what I want to focus on some of the work on the proteins and the new direction that we're taking in the field. You can think of this also as controlling chemical reactions, and there is a whole new field there called control. So let me just give you an essence of one biological application, and then I'll end up my lecture with the new direction that we're taking right now. Francis Crick said in a famous statement that if you want to understand function, study structure. This is very famous. A statement. And with all due respect to Francis Crick, I myself convinced that actually without bridging with the dynamics, you cannot get to the function. So structures are very important, but we have to pass through dynamics, otherwise we can't get really the time scales involved in the process and the efficiency of the process and the even to what extent the process is localized in a complex systems. So let me give you an example that J.D. Burnell have reflected on, and this is hydrations of protein. This is an experiment now that done in water, just like you do in under physiological condition. And Burnell in 65, this is a quotation from one of his paper, on most protein molecule, there is, for instance, a regular formation of ice. There are two sets of ice associated with protein molecules, internal and external. So the picture that comes, and that has been modified somewhat, but the picture that basically is that in order to get protein to fold in water, there is the hydrophobic interaction in the interior and the hydrophilic electrostatic forces on the outside, and water forms some ice around this protein molecules. In fact, the people who do dielectric relaxation, this is the picture they have, the interior of the protein, and then there is the biological water and there is bulk water. Can we probe this in the femtoh? Because, of course, obviously, the time scale, as you can see here, is limited by megahertz or gigahertz. And there has been very elegant experiments also done by NMR techniques, both at Lund and in Zurich. And I want to share with you now that we can map this out from the femtosecond on into the bulk water behavior. So how do we do this experiment? Well, just if you bear with me for a minute of how we can do it conceptually, here is an experiment done first on an amino acid tryptophan in bulk water. So we haven't gone yet to the protein. And so what we do, we switch on a dipole in tryptophan in the indole chromophore, and we switch this in femtosecond. So now the water molecule around this dipole tryptophan is a highly non-equilibrium state. It has certain time point here, and also it has certain spectra when it's in this configuration. As the water molecule relaxes around this dipole and take a new equilibrium configuration, it reaches this state, and there will be a finite time for doing this process, and its spectrum continues to shift as a function of time. So if you can do the spectral shift carefully as a function of time, following a femtosecond switching of that dipole, we get something called the hydration correlation function. And this gives us the time it will take all these dipoles to solvate, if you like, or the water molecule to solvate this dipole, and all the time components that are necessarily involved in this dynamical picture. So if you looked, just to show you, if you looked now, when the system is high in a highly non-equilibrium state, it's decaying, because obviously this state must decay into the equilibrium state. If you, on the other hand, go to the red, after you reach an equilibrium, then it should rise. So we do this about 50 of these as a function of time, and you can see that it's decaying and it keeps get less until you see a buildup, and from this you get the correlation function of the solvation around this particular dipole. And if you do this experiment, for example, we did it in about four proteins. Here is one of them, monolin, which is actually 50,000 times sweeter than your sugar. And it was isolated here from Serendipity Berry, And this is very interesting for us because there's one amino acid tryptophan that's lying on the surface of this protein. So the idea is that since we know quite a bit about what's happening if we take the amino acid in the bulk water, now we can do it on the surface of the monolin protein to find out how the water relaxes. The structure tells us this. This is a structure obtained from Cambridge Data Bank. And you can see here is a tryptophan. It's a single site that exists here at the surface. And we would like to see how is it being hydrated in real time. This is not an easy experiment because usually when you excite a protein as such, a big protein with a light pulse to start the process, there is also tyrosine. And so we worked almost for a year to try to tune the femtosecond pulse selectively so we can only see the tryptophan and very, very little of the tyrosine so we can do the hydration dynamics on the site at the surface of the protein. Now, I showed you the bulk behavior, and the bulk behavior here is in the red, which is what happens if we have this amino acid in the bulk. And now, on the surface of this protein, it's completely different. We see what appears to be a bulk-type behavior at very, very short time on the femtosecond time scale, and then it evolves and goes into about 30 picosecond at very long time. We're seeing a dynamical water on the surface of this protein that is exchanging with the bulk on the time scale much slower than the relaxation or solvation in real bulk by about two orders of magnitude. If we look at the theory, and I don't have the time to dwell too much on this, obviously there is a whole distribution of water molecules around the surface, but we have one site. We have only one site of this tryptophan, which we can genetically modify and move around the surface. But despite the fact that we have one site, we see this bulk-type behavior at short time, trajectories, and also we see that we have a residence times that can go up to about, with a time constant of about 30 to 40 picosecond. Remarkably, and I was surprised about this, that no matter what is the distribution of the binding energies of the hydrogen bonded to the protein, essentially this bimodal type behavior coming from the femtosecond all the way to the picosecond is robust. Can we do something to probe the thickness of the layer? So we we added a probe that we know it's about 7 angstrom away from the surface of the protein. This is another protein also that has tryptophan at the surface. And we can also modify this site by adding by having this probe sticking out really into the bulk water. So if the picture is right, and we want to know something about the layer thickness here, we can probe the hydration here and the hydration there. Here we should get the exchange or residence time. Here we should see bulk type behavior since we are roughly outside the water layer. And this is what was observed and published very recently in PNAS. What do you see here? Here is the protein with the single tryptophan going again with this bimodal type behavior. But once we stick out by about 7 angstrom, we're recovering back essentially all of bulk behavior with a very little of this exchange type solvation of the protein. This really opens for us a variety of many other experiments to be done on this kind of dynamics, including obviously the denature aspect of the protein. We have quite a bit of experiments now denaturing these proteins. In fact, we are hoping very soon to do this in real time. So we have two times, one for how the proteins are hydrated as they unfold, and the other one is to see the unfolding also in real time, hoping to learn much more about these dynamics. Now, the dynamics is very interesting because the taste itself is controlled by this process. In this particular case of the sweetness, it's the result of the interaction between the monolin and the complex G protein as you go into this cell. And the question here, what are the time scales compared to the diffusion controlled processes in the bulk water, the so-called desolvation? In other words, to what extent water has to exchange with the bulk as one protein recognize the other protein. So we believe we are shining some light here in a double meaning on the mechanism by which these proteins are recognizing each other. And we cannot claim that we have the whole picture yet, but we are working on a variety of this dynamical processes at the interface for molecular recognition. Let me just switch to this area that we are very excited about, and this is the future. This is an area that have been of fundamental interest to me, but we have not had too much success, except last year, which I consider, at least from my perspective, that we have a breakthrough here. And that is the fact that we want to use electrons to be able to get ultimately the molecular structure all at once and see this also changing with time. So we can get the landscape in different coordinates, it changing as a function of time. So we're using electrons as a way of doing this. And just to show you how backward we were, this was taken several years ago as the first electron diffraction data from our laboratory was about 10 to 20 picosecond pulses of electrons. And as you can see, this is nothing to be proud of, but nevertheless, we published because it was the first time that you can really see this almost in a density that has never been seen before and with sensitivity that we could not do any better. But recently, last year, we published in Science a paper which we had the third generation of an apparatus designed totally different, and I don't have the time to go there. And now we can reach 500 femtosecond of electron pulse duration. And in fact, we can see images now with a sensitivity reaching about 1,000 to 1 in background. The electron gun itself took about a year, but I'll show it in femtoseconds. And the detection system itself took another year, but I also show it in femtoseconds. And you can see that this is a standard molecule that you put in the machine. This is carbon tetrachloride, for example. And you can see, we can see the internuclear distances directly with a sensitivity of more than 1,000 to 1. Of course, our goal here is not carbon tetrachloride, but how can we see things changing with time to get the molecular structure? And I am very pleased to tell you that the sensitivity is enormous. Now with the new system, this is all CCD cameras of the highest sensitivity. Not only we can see now the rings with much higher sensitivity, but we can see the change as a function of time of this directly on the CCD camera. So if there is a chemical reaction changing from negative time to positive time, we're actually seeing this happening in front of our eyes on the CCD camera. And you can put molecules in the machine nowadays, one after the other. I'm just showing you two. You can see it very well if your eye is not too sensitive to the blue. But here is two molecules with different things, and you can see the change in time being different. What can you do with this? Well, I think even we finished now, as far as my group is concerned, the chemical applications, because one of the things we were dreaming of is to find out about the molecular structure of, say, reactive intermediate. This is an ethane-type molecule. We broke the first bond here, and here is the intermediate in its way out to break the second halogen out and form ethylene. And we now can tell you what is this intermediate structure after 1 picosecond. We froze it in 1 picosecond and looked with the electrons at that short time, and we can tell you that actually this intermediate had these bond distances, the carbon-carbon, carbon-halogen. Compare it with the parent molecule and with the final product. And you can tell the structure very clearly because it was proposed in the literature that the structure will be bridged. The halogen of this intermediate will be in between the two carbon. Actually, theory and experiments do not agree at all. And on the other hand, if it's a classical structure as such, the agreement is quite good. So we, for a reactive intermediate of an organic system, we can do it. And we can do it even building on the idea of multiple pulses, because we now can pulse the electrons at different times and use different combinations, which we have done. And so we can tune into specific intermediate and get the electronic, the molecular structure in the process of a change. This is the very recent data on an aromatic molecule opening the ring, and you're making an open structure going through the transition state. And I'm showing you this because this is really a beautiful example of how this works. The red ones are the old bonds in this aromatic systems, the primary carbon-carbon and the secondary carbon-carbon in this ring. But when you open the ring going through the transition state, you make double bonds and single bonds and the very long bonds. And we see that, double, single, and very long bonds. And so we can follow this now as a function of time to find out how the old bonds are broken and the new bonds are being formed. And that we did this year, was published, and you can see how the images are changing and how the system is evolving as a function of time until you form this new and intermediate structure on the way out. By the way, opening the bond in benzene and pyridine was not predicted. Everybody thought this will be isomer structure like the Kekulé and the like when you energize the molecule, but it turns out actually the molecule opens up the ring. You can go to more complex systems, and this was published recently in Angavanta Shimei. This is an iron pentacarbonyl, and you're looking at different intermediates in the way out, and we froze this one here after one or two picoseconds, and then we wanted to refine this molecular structure, the intermediate, find out really what does reaction do in real time. And when we did this, we discovered actually that the proposed species for this intermediate was not quite right because it was thought to be a triplet structure. It turns out to be a single structure, as you can see from the agreement between the theory and the experiment. And therefore, we can refine this molecular structure by iteration methods. And this we did. And this is now the intermediate state of this molecular structure on the way to separate and blow out all this carbon monoxide. So applications are quite rich here. I don't mean to give you too many examples, but here is another one where we have a cyclopentadienyl cobalt dicarbonyl, and we can also find out which channels in this reaction and that this is the dominant species being formed in the way out. And I don't have to show you all the data for this. But if we are marching toward the biological system, there are two things we wanted to do to make sure that we are on the right track. One is that in many of these systems I showed you, there is a heavy atom. So in a little bit of cheating here, in that we know that the scattering cross-section is much larger for the electrons with a heavy atom. Can we do this in a carbon-hydrogen system? Because I have some plans for some of the conformation changes in amino acids and proteins and so on. Polypeptides. So we actually looked at some cyclic systems here of only carbon hydrogens. This is cycloheptatriene and this cyclohexadiene and cycloheptatriene. And here, actually, the ring, the molecules becomes hot. And can we probe this? And here the molecules open the ring as shown by the time-resolved electron diffraction. Can we see this? And we did see it. And this also has been published. But what really surprised us is the quite high sensitivity that we can achieve nowadays. For example, these are the two molecules I mentioned to you. And you can see that the electron diffraction data is very different. And now we can tune into a given bond here and look at the temporal change of how the system is either is being heated up on that particular bond or opening up this particular bond at the structure. And this data shows, for example, for cyclohexatriene, heptatriene, and the other one, is that the time constants actually are quite different for these two molecules. One is 16 picoseconds, and the other one for opening up this ring is taking 32 picoseconds. But this is exciting because now we are tuning into a given internuclear separation in the molecules to try to see how the molecular structure can be done. I'm going to just tell you about the, we are quite excited about this. We have three machines going on at Caltech. Almost half of our group is devoted now to this area. And in fact, as we speak, we just finished the assembly of a new machine because we're looking now of molecules on surfaces. The goal is to go to the very complex and including also some biological systems that we hope to report to you soon. And by having the electron pulses here, which we now know how to do, this apparatus cost us about $1.5 million because it is quite elaborate in terms of having lead techniques, in terms of having the ultra-fast electron diffraction. It has also mass spectrometry in it. It has quite a bit of combination of things in order to characterize this large system that we want, and having the system on a surface to look both at the diffraction techniques, and also we have some other ideas for backscattering and other. So here is a snapshot of this apparatus called the UED4, and basically we have a whole transfer chamber here which can characterize our surface material, the lead OJ and so on, and the cleaning. This is took a lot of work to design this machine by very able postdocs in our group, which I'll mention in a few minutes. And then we have the loading dock here, and then we go into this whole diffraction area, which also have a time of flight mass spectrometer, so we can both look at the mass by using the new techniques of electrospray and the like, and then to just to learn about what kind of composition we have, and then we can do the diffraction on the surface after we have characterized the surface totally. I was speaking last night with Professor Forsane and Professor Nordane on the idea of proteins on surfaces and how important this is. They tell me also, so they assure me that this will be a significant development if we can do it on the surface. And so we're hoping very much very soon to be able to look at in situ macromolecular systems there. And don't be, we were told in the beginning of the field it's not going to work, even for the systems that I mentioned to you, because everybody have calculated the number of electrons and the space charge problems and so on. Probably Aaron Kluge heard the same thing when he was trying to do his beautiful work. But the key thing is that even when we get to large molecules, the experts will say you can't get all the internuclear separations here, but that's not the point. The point is that we will be able to look at major conformational changes and also local dynamical changes, which are crucial to the function of these systems. And I believe this is quite exciting for the future. Well, this could not have been done since we have international students here from all over the place. I just want to show you a snapshot here. We enjoy quite a bit of international representation in our group, and this is over the years. It doesn't include the last 2 years, but in the last 2 years, we had an outstanding group of people. This was on a happy occasion at Caltech, and you can see here they are all smiling. They're having a great time. They're even drinking around here. They're doing all kinds of things. This is my colleague at Caltech, but this is Dr. Spencer Baskin, who is a senior postdoc, senior associate in our group, and is really very crucial for many of these. Here is Ramesh. He's from India and was crucial in the development of electron diffraction with Dr. Vladimir Lobastov here from the Soviet Union, from Russia. And he's actually is a calibrated experimentalist for designing some of this apparatus. Vladimir was involved. And Rowan, I'm trying to look for him here. I can't find him. He's hidden somewhere. And the rest, you can see them smiling. And this is the most important graduate student I have in my group. She's my wife. So thank you very much.